Good morning. It is so good to see those of you who are here in person, those of you watching from home. We want you to know how glad we are that you continue to join us, and we continue to be here for you wherever you are, in person or at home. We continue to journey together. We enjoy connecting together. We hope you'll join us soon when you feel good about that and it's safe to join us on a Sunday morning. We look forward to next Sunday night, and we would love to see you there at our bonfire. We continue to make progress here. We're getting closer. So last week, for those of you who listened to the sermon, you may remember that I told a story that is a well-known story by a preacher, sociologist Tony Campolo, in which he describes throwing a birthday party in the middle of the night for a woman named Agnes. It was at a diner in Honolulu, and Agnes happened to be a prostitute along with a lot of the friends of hers that were in the diner at that time. And after the party had begun and there was a little bit of time, the cook looked over at Campolo and said, "You never told me you were a preacher. What kind of church do you belong to?" And Campolo famously answered, "The kind that throws parties, birthday parties, for prostitutes at 3:30 in the morning." And the cook said, "No, you don't. That kind of church doesn't exist. If it did, I would go to that kind of church." And I lamented last week that it's true, there are not enough of those kinds of churches, but we can't lay that at the feet of Jesus, because what we remembered last week, the whole first half of Luke 14, is Jesus describing the kind of kingdom that God is creating and the kind of God we follow and worship. The God we worship is a feast-throwing God, a banquet-throwing God. And that God includes, invites everyone to the banquet. And yes, it includes the usual suspects of people, but God is also insistent that all the folks that normally get left out, all the folks that never get an invite, the kinds of folks you wouldn't even notice weren't at the table, they get a special invitation to the table. Go out to the countryside. Go out to the alleyways. You compel them to come in. People who are poor and people with all kinds of disabilities, everybody is included, especially the nobodies. But here's something that's helpful to keep in mind about that time. And that is, when someone found themselves in a place of disadvantage, or if someone had some sort of disability, there was a common understanding about why that was. And it had been around for a long time, hundreds of years. And the understanding went a little something like this: someone done something wrong to be like that. If someone had a disability, if someone was disadvantaged, it's because someone sinned. There must be sin in the story to get them to that place. But what Jesus keeps reminding us is that all of those people who are left out and pushed aside, all of those people who are disadvantaged and who have disabilities, they are not cursed by God. If anything, Jesus says, they are blessed and beloved by God. But the religious righteous aren't buying it. They've got a problem with that line of thinking, and they've got a problem with the logic that leads Jesus to of the kind of people that he continues to spend time with. And so the question that keeps running through their heads and sometimes coming out of their mouths is something like this: Yeah, but what about all of those we know are sinners? Which leads us to our text this morning in Luke 15. If you have your Bibles, open up to Luke 15. We're going to start in verse 1, a very familiar chapter from Luke, and you'll see that on the screen behind me. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, there's a couple of things to notice here. And one is, it's not just the religious righteous that refer to this large group of people as sinners. Luke uses the same term. And we're familiar enough, we've even talked about in this series, the story behind tax collectors. They were notorious cheats and thieves and also seen as traitors against their own people. But who are these folks that fall under this super generic term, this large umbrella term of sinners? Do you think that includes... Yeah, I'm sure it does. Well, does that also involve... Yeah, probably. Well, what about all the people who... Yeah, undoubtedly, they fall under that description of sinner too. In fact, anyone in the minds of the religious righteous who don't measure up to the Torah and their practice and understanding of the Torah fall under that description of sinner. Which brings us to the beef that the Pharisees and the teachers of Torah have with Jesus in regard to these people. Jesus lets these folks hang out with him, and he teaches them, for one thing, Jesus has some questionable followers. And I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm looking at some of them right now. Jesus has always had some questionable followers. But Jesus goes a step further because Jesus treats followers as friends. He welcomes these questionable followers as friends, and he eats with them. He fellowships with them. And to fellowship and eat with someone in the ancient world was a sign of embrace, of acceptance. It is a larger welcome than just sitting in the same dining room at Chipotle or Tzatziki's after church. This is a sign of embrace and true welcome. And you can imagine, this is not just a rigid, refined, staid, stoic sharing of food together. The food is a feast, and the feast is a fiesta. It is a celebration. And so verse 2, getting into the mind of the religious righteous, that they're upset that Jesus welcomes and eats with tax collectors and sinners. That launches the next three stories. That is the setup to the familiar punchline that we know of these stories. And we're going to get to the stories in just a minute. But before we do that, I'm going to invite a little audience participation. Kids, you guys have been doing so well, and I want to invite you to help me out. I've got a question for you. Now, I'm going to ask a question, and the first person, Miss Jennifer, is going to help me with this, so she's going to be my eyes after I ask this question, and the first person to get it right, kids, I've got a $10 Sonic gift card for you that Miss Jennifer is going to give you, and I'm thinking maybe you can convince your parents to drive you to Sonic, and then you can buy the treat for the family. Family, I've just given you a task. How does that sound? You're welcome. Okay, so kids, I want you to listen. Don't raise your hand until I ask the question, okay? Sit on the hand until I get to the question. NASA, that's the government agency that sends rockets to space and astronauts to space. They were in the news recently. They just successfully finished the first part of a mission that they call Perseverance, which is a great name for a mission to take, a rocket to an alien body, an alien planet. It's also a great name for the mission to get through the last year that all of us have been trying to do. Perseverance. We're all on mission Perseverance right now. Okay, kids, here's your question. Are you ready? When you hear the question, if you know the answer, raise your hand. What planet did they land on? Okay? What planet? Call it out. Mars. Absolutely right. They landed on the planet Mars. That is the Mars rover, Perseverance rover that you're seeing right there, that will travel around Mars. Excellent job. Well done. Okay, adults, it's going to be your turn in just a minute. Yours is going to be a smidge harder than the one I asked the kids. And Jennifer's going to help pass out that card too. I'm going to try to make sure no one's Googling while I'm asking the question. You're on the honor system here. This one's a little harder. And adults, you'll get a $10 Starbucks gift card. That's what I've got for you. Okay, as I talk about this, there's a video that's going to play. So this first video you're going to see is the landing portion. That was the heat shield that has just flown off, that's been jettisoned. And now you're seeing several cameras. The rover is being lowered to the ground. You see the Mars surface on the right. And up above is the sky crane that is slowly lowering the Mars rover to the ground. That's a very cool image. And this last image was the sky crane as it flew off, after it let go of the rover. Okay, second video is after Perseverance just made it through the upper atmosphere and it deploys this massive parachute to help slow the descent to the surface. Okay, you may notice on the parachute, and I've got an image, I'll show you again, that there are all kinds of patterns and designs that were woven into this parachute. And NASA did that for a couple of reasons. It helped them track how the parachute inflated, and it helped determine clocking orientation of the parachute for future missions and how it deploys. But the question is coming here, and you had to have read about this or seen it in the news. NASA also included a secret message in that image using binary code in the orange and white triangles. Okay, the question is, what is the secret message? For a $10 Starbucks gift card, and there's actually two, and I'll give it to you if you even know one of them. What is the secret message? You would have had to have read about it or watched it on the news. This is also the time to tell you, if no one gets it, I get to keep the Starbucks gift card. Now you know why I made it harder than just answering what planet they landed on. Okay, does anyone know what the secret message was? What's that? Oh no? Phone home. That would have been fantastic. That is not the secret message. Okay, so there's two parts to the secret message. Part one, you can go ahead and show the next slide, is the GPS coordinates for the Jet Propulsion Lab. And the second part is the Jet Propulsion Lab's motto, which is Dare Mighty Things. Isn't that impressive? If someone comes up to me afterward and you impress me with some other tidbit that I didn't know about, I'll give you the Starbucks gift card. So I'll leave that up to you. Now let me tell you about why I'm telling that story and why they have to do so much there at the end of the mission. I want to describe to you what NASA calls the 7 minutes of terror. Did any of you hear about this or read about this in the news? The 7 minutes of terror. So Perseverance actually launched 7 months ago. It takes a long time to make it from Earth to Mars, and they actually timed it to where Mars and Earth would be as close as it would be for about 2 years because their orbits are not the same in distance to the sun and even how they line up. And so they launched it just right to be the shortest trip it could be. This entire mission has cost about $2.5 billion. There have been people who have been working on this Perseverance mission for about 10 years. This is not something you do last minute. They've been working and working, dreaming and all of these efforts for all of this time. And the whole trip from Earth to Mars, NASA has been in communication with Perseverance. But the further away Perseverance gets from Earth, the longer it takes for communication to get from Earth to Perseverance. So by the time Perseverance was outside in orbit around Mars, it takes a minimum of 11 minutes for a signal to get from Earth to Mars, sometimes up to 15 minutes. But the most dangerous part of the trip was not the 7 months. It is the last 7 minutes of the trip, what NASA calls the 7 minutes of terror, because that's how long it takes to get from the upper atmosphere and go through all of that heat to eventually make it to the ground, where they can encounter all kinds of wind gusts and they have the surface terrain that they've got to worry about. They can't just land anywhere, can't land on hills, they can't land near cliffs. They've got to land in a place that's safe, and you've got to go down slow enough and eventually soft enough that you don't break anything in the process, because if you break an axle when you land, there's no one there to fix it. Matt Damon is not still on Mars. There's no way you're doing anything for the rover. And so what NASA has to do is, after all that time and all that effort and all that energy and all that money, they have to turn it loose. They can't control the Perseverance descent to the ground because it takes the signal too long. They have to turn it loose to rely on the instruments and all of the programming. They have to turn it loose to do what it was designed to do for all of those 10 years. And then they wait. Because by the time they receive a signal again, it's already through the atmosphere and on the ground. The question is it on the ground in one piece, functioning, and ready to do the task that it had been built to do for 10 years, or is it in pieces? Is it in flames? So you have this thing that you love dearly, that you spent all this time pouring yourself into, working for and caring for and losing sleep over and dreaming about. And at the time when it is most vulnerable, most at risk, in the greatest danger, that's the time when you lose contact, you lose control, you can no longer decide its fate. 7 minutes of terror. So when you finally make contact again, when you reconnect, when you can communicate and you know everything is good, everything is safe, everything is right, this thing that you've poured yourself into will be able to live out its mission, its created purpose. How do you respond? Well, it looks a little something like this.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
So Jesus has gathered around him all of these unwanted people of ill repute. And the religious righteous mutter, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. And the food is a feast, and the feast is a fiesta." And Jesus doesn't deny it. Jesus doesn't debate it. Instead, Jesus describes three scenarios that we know really well. He starts with a story of someone who has 100 sheep and loses one. Doesn't that person leave the 99, drop everything, and go after the one? And when Jesus talks about sheep and shepherds, he's not just digging into an idea that pastoral society would be familiar with. He's also digging into an image that shows up a lot in the Old Testament to describe the leaders of God's people. The leaders of God's people are the shepherds. And much of the criticism that shows up in the Old Testament regarding the leaders of God's people is that they fail their duties as shepherds. They don't protect the sheep. And when they lose a sheep, they don't go after those lost sheep. And you may have noticed that when Jesus starts this parable, he doesn't start in the same generic way that he starts some other parables. He doesn't start by saying, "Suppose a man..." What does he say? Talking to a group of religious leaders, what does he say? "Suppose one of you..." He puts them in the story right at the beginning. "You're the shepherd. Will you be a good shepherd of the sheep?" And then what Jesus does is he ends the story the same way that he'll end every one of these stories, with rejoicing and celebration, a party with friends and family, and this reminder: whatever rejoicing that happens on earth will pale in comparison to the real party happening in heaven. When someone who is lost is found, when someone who's been heading in the wrong way turns and heads in the right way, which is what repentance means, when connection is restored and relationship is repaired, when the broken are mended. And then Jesus moves to another story. A woman with 10 coins loses one. Is this a woman of great poverty where losing one-tenth of her savings is a huge blow? Or is this some sort of wedding dowry? There's a lot of speculation. Jesus doesn't give us the answer to that. What he does give is a description of her desperation. She turns that house upside down until she finds it. And when she finds it, the familiar happens, right? There is rejoicing, celebration, a party with friends and family. And whatever rejoicing happens on earth pales in comparison to the real party happening in heaven. And now we come to the most famous story of the three. And to help us hear it, I've recruited one of our most passionate and celebratory readers. So Rhonda Coulson is going to read for us from Luke 15.
I'll be reading from Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 31. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back, safe and sound." The older brother was angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found."
So you may have noticed there is an escalation to these stories. We start with 1 out of 100, then we go 1 out of 10, and then we go 1 out of 2, and even that math might be a little off by the end of the story. And we've been around this story a lot, if you've been in church much your life. And so there are parts that are very familiar. We know how offensively outrageous it would be, especially in that culture, for a son to ask for his inheritance while the father is still alive. It is, in many ways, like saying, "I wish you'd already kicked the bucket so I could have now what I normally don't get until you die." And we know how odd it is that the father grants the request. And you may know how out of the norm it is for someone to leave their people and their place in the world and go off to a far land. Now kids do that all the time in our world, in our culture. It's time I grow up. It's time I get out. But that was not a common occurrence in that day. And how outrageous it was, and how the outrageousness turns to outrage when the far country that he goes to is one that is filled with debauched living, and one that we soon learn is a foreign country, a Gentile country, and we learn that by the occupation that he ends up stooping to, and then he stoops even lower because he wants to eat the food that the pigs are eating. We know the unfathomable spectacle of a dignified father humbling, humiliating himself as he watches and then runs to meet his son. And we expect the father to go after the son. Instead, what the father does is embrace him and treats him with love and mercy and dignity and pours the finest on him, clothing and jewelry. And then we get to the familiar part of the story, rejoicing, celebration, a party with friends and family, because that's what you do when someone who was dead is alive again. That's what you do when someone that was lost is found. But here's where this story turns and is different than the other two. We're used to the story ending on the party, aren't we? We're used to the story ending with the celebration. But something is different. There is a celebration that goes on, but that doesn't end the story. Not yet. There's sulking that's happening too. The older brother hears the raucous party, and he's infuriated, and he refuses to go in, and he distances himself from the brother, not calling him my brother, but this son of yours. And soon we learn from the father that the older brother isn't just missing the party this night, but the older brother has been missing the party all along. It was always available. It was always right at his fingertips. The full blessing and enjoyment of being in proximity to the Father and enjoying all that the Father had to offer is something that he kept at arm's length. And these stories have always been good news and have been celebrated as good news to those who have been lost or felt lost, who've been broken and beaten by the world and by their own self-destructive ways. And the message keeps coming back loud and clear. God always welcomes back with open arms, runs to meet the repentant, those who are ready to turn and join in the feast, which is a fiesta. But that welcome here at the end also turns to a warning to the religious righteous, the self-appointed gatekeepers and critical naysayers. God determines the guest list, whether we like it or not. The party is happening whether we choose to join or not. And it is a joyous, raucous affair. So it seems to me, in the end, the question is not, where do you see yourself in this story? Because we remember the setup that started these three stories in the first place. They weren't just out of the blue. It was in response to the religious righteous who resented the compassion and welcome of Jesus. The question is not, where do you see yourself in this story? We can be just as lost in a faraway place as we can be if we never leave home. The question is, as God's party plays on, where will you be? As God's party plays on, where will you be?